Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank Stop War Coalition and all the other organizations that have invited me here. And I think that, like many of you, most of you, all of you, the feelings of outrage at the footage that has been shown by DAR is something that we all share tonight, and hopefully we can translate into stronger resolve against this horrific crime against humanity. Let me just begin by saying that on March 18 of 2003, I still remember that as a really fine and beautiful spring day. And I was with a delegation of Asians, and we were interviewing students at Baghdad University. And we came unannounced to this class on Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, that Iraqi students were taking up. And in the course of what was a very friendly discussion, I asked the students, well, it was clear that invasion would take place within the next few days. And what did they think about this? And one of the women students raised her hand and said, well, if only George Bush knew his history, he would have known that our country has been invaded by army after army for 4,000 years, and all they left behind was the wreckage of their armies. So I think that was a statement that was very prophetic of what would come in the next 2 years. Over the next few days, millions of people throughout the world, from Vancouver to Johannesburg, London to Manila, will be coming out to the streets to register their protest against the continuing military occupation of Iraq by the United States and its allies. In the U.S. alone, the last count is that there will be anti-war actions in at least 740 cities and communities. This year's massive protests are in the tradition of the global protests against the war of February 15, 2003 and March 20, 2004. They underline the world's continuing repudiation of the massive war crime that the U.S. is perpetrating against the Iraqi people. They are testimony to the fact that aggression always elicits revulsion, even if it is carried out under the pretext of, quote, extending democracy. The protests come at a time that Washington has launched another political offensive to convince the peoples of the world to, quote, put Iraq behind them. The effort is geared to convince us that with the recent elections in Iraq, there is a new game that must be played, and the name of that game is democracy. The reality is that the old game of domination and occupation continues, and the U.S. is not winning. Today, we continue to witness the rise and consolidation of a wide and deep resistance in Iraq. There is not only the military resistance that we witness day to day on television, there is also political resistance, one that is more varied and much broader than the military resistance. Then there is something even broader, and that is civil resistance. All those acts that ordinary citizens engage in day to day to deny legitimacy to the occupation, or what James C. Scott calls the weapons of the weak. For us, there must be no question about our political stance. We must support the right of the people of Iraq to resist occupation. There are varieties of resistance, but we must remember that what the Iraqi people want mainly from us is not to support this or that brand of resistance, but to demand the unconditional and immediate withdrawal of all foreign troops from Iraq. Only under this condition will the Iraqi people have the sovereign space to come together, to debate and struggle among themselves to create a truly legitimate national government, to call elections carried out under occupation, quote, free and democratic, unquote, is a travesty of freedom and democracy. The truth is that the U.S. is losing the war in Iraq, both politically and militarily. Over the last few months, at least 10 allied governments have withdrawn or indicated they are withdrawing their troops. Indeed, the so-called coalition of the willing is now so reduced that the Pentagon has dropped the term and started using, quote, multinational forces, unquote, instead. The 135,000 U.S. troops are stretched thin, their numbers unable to stop the wildfire rise of a guerrilla insurgency. Estimates of military experts of the minimum necessary number to fight the guerrillas to a stalemate range from 200,000 to 1 million troops. It is impossible to attain these numbers without provoking massive civil resistance in the United States, where the majority of the population, in fact, polls now say 60%, see the military intervention as unjustified. Mr. Bush may have won the elections, but it was not because of public support for the war, and he knows this. In the U.S. military itself, more and more troops, even on active duty, along with their families, are speaking out against the war. A few weeks ago, television audiences worldwide witnessed an assembly of troops applauding criticism of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld by an officer who accused him of sending the troops to war without sufficient protection. We have also witnessed an American unit that refused to deliver supplies to a city several miles away because they said their vehicles were unsafe. There are probably more and more such incidents if journalists bothered to look instead of embedding themselves with the Pentagon. The U.S. Army, one must recall, fell apart internally at the last stages of the Vietnam War owing to demoralization, which took the form of, among other things, the, quote, fragging of officers or throwing grenades at them. With about 40% of the army troops in Iraq being non-regular forces with the National Guard, people who are not full-time soldiers, the steady erosion of morale among U.S. units must not be underestimated. Probably the only soldiers that can resist demoralization are the stupidly gung-ho Marines, but they are a minority in what is otherwise an army show. But the U.S. is not only overextended in Iraq. Iraq, in fact, has worsened the crisis of overextension of the U.S. globally. The key manifestations of the imperial dilemma stand out starkly. One, despite the recent U.S.-sponsored elections in Afghanistan, the Karzai government effectively controls only parts of Kabul and two or three other cities. As U.N. General Secretary Kofi Annan has said, despite the elections, and I quote, without functional state institutions able to serve the basic needs of the population throughout the country, the authority and legitimacy of the new government will be short-lived, unquote. And as long as this is the case, Afghanistan will tie down 13,500 U.S. troops within the country and 35,000 support personnel outside. And I think, just parenthetically, this again reinforces the importance of what Dar said about making sure Canadian troops do not fill in the gap in Afghanistan and allow U.S. troops to be released to go to Iraq. Second, the U.S. war on terror has backfired completely, with al-Qaeda and its allies much stronger today than in 2001. The invasion of Iraq, according to Richard Clark, Bush's former anti-terrorism czar, derailed the war on terror and served as the best recruiting device for al-Qaeda. But even without Iraq, Washington's heavy-handed police and military methods of dealing with terrorism were already alienating millions of Muslims. Nothing illustrates this more than southern Thailand, where U.S. anti-terrorist advice has helped convert simmering discontent into a full-blown insurgency. Third, with its full embrace of Ariel Sharon's no-win strategy of sabotaging the emergence of a Palestinian state, Washington has forfeited all the political capital it had gained among Arabs by brokering the now-defunct Oslo Accord. Moreover, the go-with-Sharon strategy along with the occupation of Iraq, has left Washington's allies among the Arab elites exposed, discredited, and vulnerable. With the death of Yasser Arafat, Tel Aviv and Washington may entertain hopes of a settlement of the Palestinian issue on their terms. This is an illusion, and we will probably see this in growing support for Hamas among the Palestinians at the expense of Mr. Abbas's PLO. Fifth, Latin America's move to the left will accelerate. The victory of the leftist coalition in Uruguay is simply the latest in a series of electoral victories for progressive forces following those in Venezuela, Ecuador, Argentina, and Brazil. Along with electoral turns to the left, there may also be in the offing more mass insurrections, such as that which occurred in Bolivia in October 2003 and deposed the Gonzalo Lozada government, Sanchez de Lozada government. Speaking of the turn towards the left and away from the empire, one of the USS friends, former Foreign Minister of Mexico Jorge Castañeda, assesses the situation accurately, and I quote, "America's friends are feeling the fire of this anti-American wrath. They are finding themselves forced to shift their own rhetoric and attitude in order to dampen their defense of policies viewed as pro-American or U.S.-inspired and to stiffen their resistance to Washington's demands and desires." End quote. Indeed, the fires of anti-Americanism and anti-neoliberalism are at their height in Latin America at this point. This is the global picture that belies the triumphalism that accompanied Bush's recent European tour. This enterprise sought to enlist diplomacy in the service of countering the erosion of the American position. It was a trip undertaken out of desperation. One can in fact say that while the papers had been filled with bellicose words from Washington against Syria, Iran, and North Korea, the reality is that, owing to its being pinned down in an endless war in Iraq, the U.S. is in less of a position to destabilize these governments than it was in 2003, before the invasion of Iraq. And indeed, I would just like to point out that probably reflecting these major failures, one on North Korea, which was headed up by John Bolton, and then on Iraq, which was partly headed up by Paul Wolfowitz, there must be something beyond what has been reported in the newspapers about the transfer of Bolton away from the State Department and the transfer of Wolfowitz away from the Defense Department. What we are witnessing is the third major PR effort to convince the world that Iraq has been pacified. The first was the famous declaration of victory on board the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln in May 2003. Now, we all know what happened to that. The second was the transfer of sovereignty to the Iraqi people last June. A sharp escalation of resistance followed that forgettable episode. Now, this effort to convince the world, relying on television images, that elections carried out under military occupation and amidst wide resistance, which were boycotted by millions of Iraqi voters, were an exercise in freedom and democracy. Indeed, this latest PR effort is not going to be effective very long, as Dar has already underlined. Europe is, of course, the special target of the Bush strategy. The shift in the assessment of Europe's position brought about by the hard realities of the Iraq resistance is illustrated by the neoconservative ideologue Robert Kagan. In 2002, Kagan spoke disparagingly of Europe's approach to world order, with his notorious comment that, quote, "Americans are from Mars and Europeans are from Venus," end quote. In 2004, the same Kagan had changed his tune somewhat, writing in Foreign Affairs that, quote, "Americans will need the legitimacy that Europe can provide, but Europeans may well fail to grant it," end quote. Fortunately, Europeans are not being taken in by the, quote, "new conciliatory Bush." The liberal financial regards the new approach as constituting, quote, "a belated recognition that the U.S. is overstretched and is in need of allies," end quote, though it cautions Europeans against adopting a new do-nothing attitude towards the Bush initiative.